comeuppance, you have my gratitude for the role you played. And for what you told me of Justin. She smiled at Jocelyn. Both of you. What became of your friend? She asked then, remembering. The Tsingano. Is he with Guilin's army? It hurt to think of Hyacinth. I caught my breath and met Jocelyn's eye, glancing round from the arrow slit. No, Your Majesty, I said. It is a long story, our journey, and Hyacinth's may be the longest. A mendicant's tale, murmured Jocelyn. We told her then, there on the battlements of besieged Toilemont, while arrows clattered against the Merlin and her guards kept watch. I began it, but Jocelyn told it better, with all the skill he'd gained in his mendicant guise. It was his tribute to Hyacinth, and I let him have it, as he had let me have mine, the last night on that lonely isle. Hyacinth would have liked it, I think. Gaspard Trevelyan came back to find his queen round-eyed with awe, uncertain whether or not to credit our tale.
De Marché is ready, he said brusquely, returning us to the dire reality of our situation. He'll fire on my command. Any sign of d'Aiglemont or the Albans?
No, my lord. I had been watching while Jocelyn told the story of Hyacinth and the Master of the Straits. Not yet. Gaspard glanced up at the sky, turning a pale blue as the sun rose steadily.
Pray they don't fail us, he said grimly. They've near filled the moat with rubble at the Barbican, and Selig's sappers are digging under the northwest tower. Farron said they felt the stone tremble underfoot. They're moving one of the siege towers toward the north wall, too. We've let them get deadly close if help doesn't come.
It will come, I said, with a confidence I didn't feel. It was harder to believe here.
It is coming. Jocelyn, back at the arrow slit, pressed his eye to the aperture, his hands flat against the wall, clenched, fingertips digging into stone. It is coming, my lord. Look!
Heedless of station, he grabbed Gaspard's arm and drew him to the wall. Gaspard Trevelyan looked silently, then drew back.
Your Majesty,
he said, gesturing for her to look. Isande took a turn for a long moment, then stepped away and drew a shuddering breath.
Phaedra, she whispered, you brought them. You should see.
I stepped up to the arrow slit, standing once more on my toes and ignoring the pain of my injuries, and looked. In the distance, at the base of the foothills, a shining line of silver advanced toward the fortress. High on the battlements of Toilemont, we had the advantage of sight, despite the greater distance. Still, it was not long before Selig's sentries spotted their advance. None of his scouting parties had returned alive, and it was a mercy that Guilin had found a path where they could descend undetected. But there was no hiding an entire army once they were on level ground. I gave way to Isandra at the arrow slit. She was queen, I could do no less, but it was agony not to see. I bore it as long as I could, then stepped out from behind the Merlin to stand at the low crenellation. Jocelyn was a mere step behind me, and I thought for an instant that he would drag me back to safety, but he merely gave me a quick glance and set himself at my side, vambraces crossed before him. We didn't have much to fear, as the attention of the Scaldi began to shift direction. Nothing I have ever seen can compare to it, unless it be the seas roiling under the duress of the Master of the Straits. It was so vast, the Scaldi army, spread like an ocean across the plain. Word came from the eastern rearguard, the tiny figures of Selig's sentries pelting across the torn ground, and the mighty army began to surge. It hit the outskirts of his forces with a ripple, and built to a swell, moving toward us. By the time it crested and broke against the fortress, throwing our attackers into chaos, the silver line of advancing soldiers had drawn nearer. The outermost ranks of Scaldi broke, racing on foot and on horse across the plain to engage the oncoming enemy. The silver line halted and shrank, kneeling, and Guilin de Sommerville's Lanyasite archers fired over their heads, a rain of black arrows arching down on the Scaldi. Then the line rose, shields raised to form a bar of silver, and advanced. These were Carmeline soldiers, born to the sword, and drilled within an inch of their lives. Undisciplined and fierce with battle, the Scaldi broke against them like a wave against a wall, crashing, falling, dashed back, and the wall advanced. At the base of the fortress, milling confusion ensued, Scaldi sappers and engineers abandoning their posts. Fearless in the melee, Voldemar Selig rode back and forth shouting at them, ordering them to hold their places. Disorderly and milling, they held, enough to hold our forces pinned within Toilemont. Far across the plain, the silver line of Deglamore's infantry pushed forward, moving relentlessly into the Scaldi horde, which overran them on both sides, threatening to overwhelm them with sheer numbers. That was when the Alban forces struck. Cavalry to the right flank and war chariots to the left, foot soldiers swarming after both, streaming from behind the Carmeline infantry, wild and terrifying, they threw the entire battle into chaos. But the numbers were against them. Even at this distance I could see the blood run in rivers of red, see our allies cut down. I turned without realizing it, found my hands clutching at Gaspard Trevelyan's arm. "Give the signal!" I begged him, desperate. "They're dying out there!" At the foot of the fortress beyond the moat, Selig's discipline held, 10,000 strong. Gaspard shook his head, ignoring my grip.
"We have to make it out the gate," he said, his voice heavy with grief. "We're no good to them if Selig's men can pick us off one by one."
I whirled away from him with a sharp cry, staring across the battlefield. Near drowning in a sea of Scaldi, still somehow the Carmeline infantry held its line. Now they dug in, shields raised, fending off the dreadful numbers, and parted. Slowly, like a massive gate opening, the line broke and opened. A single horn sounded, clear and defiant, its sound rising above the shouting. Into the breach the Carmeline cavalry charged, the allies of Cumlach, all who remained, with Isidore Deglamore at their head. "He betrayed our nation and all we hold dear. I make no excuse for that. But if the poets sing of the last charge of Isidore Deglamore, they do so with reason. I know. I was there. I saw the mounted allies of Cumlach drive into tens of thousands of Scaldi like a wedge, faces bright with Carmeel's battle fire, swords singing. The shock of it went clear through the Scaldic army. I heard the cry that arose, too, as the Scaldi gave way before them, some dying, some swirling away.
"Kilbohar!" they cried, falling and fleeing. "Kilbohar!"
On his tall horse, Voldemar Selig turned, sensing himself the target of that fierce, driving wedge. All around the sides of battle, Scaldi and Alban fought, desperate and bloody, the Scaldi numbers prevailing. But the centre was coming for him. Selig rode back and forth. Selig drew his sword and held it aloft in one massive fist, while the White Brethren flanked him and his forces roiled. Isidore Deglamore drove toward his heart.
"Kilbohar!"
Selig roared, pumping his sword arm skyward. Wheeling his horse, he plunged toward the centre of the battle, scattering his own forces.
"Kilbohar!"
Howling, the Scaldi followed.
"Now!"
Gaspard Trevelyan shouted. His standard-bearer waved the corsel swan with wild urgency, and the trebuchet crew set torches to the Feu de Hellas and loosed the counterweights. The bucket sprang forward, casting an arching mass of liquid flame over the eastern front of the Scaldi army. In the courtyard, Percy de Somerville gave a single command. Up came the portcullis, dented by the battering ram. Down came the drawbridge, and the keepers of the barbican loosed a cover of crossbow fire. Four by four, the defenders of Toilemont came streaming forth, reforming in neat lines and falling on the rearguard of Selig's men. Truly, the Scaldi were caught between hammer and anvil. We were all standing clear on the battlements now, forgotten targets, as the slaughter below ensued. Percy de Somerville's army fell on the Scaldi like lions, a siege's worth of pent rage in their blood, felling everything in their path. And at the center, Voldemar Selig drove to meet Isidore d'Eglamour. I do not need to tell it. All the world knows that story. How they came together at the heart of the battle, two titans, natural-born warriors both of them. We saw from the battlements how the shining wedge of d'Eglamour's cavalry thinned, growing narrower, driving still ever inward. How the silver eagle of death, d'Eglamour's standard, faltered at last, dipping and falling, overwhelmed beneath a sea of Scaldi. And Isidore d'Eglamour, atop his black horse, fought onward, alone. They met at the end. D'Eglamour went down, the black horse slain. We thought him lost, buried under Scaldi. Then he arose, silver hair streaming beneath his helmet, a Scaldi axe in one hand. He threw it left-handed as Selig rode up on his tall horse. He killed the horse. Always it is the innocent who suffer, the beasts of the field, the servants of Namur. So it is always in times of war. Selig's steed went down with a crash. Selig arose cursing, and they fought there on the plain, on foot and alone. They fought, the two of them, like lovers staging a showing in Sirius House. There are those who think it wrong to make such a comparison, but I was there. How many wounds Isidore d'Eglamour had taken to get there, I cannot say. They counted on his body when the armour was stripped from him. 17, no less, they counted. Some of those were Selig's, not all. Voldemar Selig, proof against weapons, so the Scaldi believed. But while battle raged around them, he fought Isidore d'Eglamour, the traitor Duke of Terdange. Fought him and died. I do not scruple to say it. When d'Eglamour's sword found a gap in Selig's armour and pierced it to the hilt, I cried out my relief. Voldemar Selig sank to his knees, disbelieving. D'Eglamour dying sank with him, both hands on his sword-hilt, thrusting it home. So they met their end. Chapter 90. Those tribal fault-lines I had so carefully traversed through the Scaldi encampment turned into gaping chasms as bands of warriors broke away, some by the thousand, others by the hundreds, and some even fracturing, steading by steading, in the scores and dozens. Percy de Somerville's troops pursued them with merciless efficiency, and at the centre of the battlefield. "Your Majesty," I pointed toward the northeast, where a band of mounted Cruinia were cutting a swath toward the site of d'Eglamour and Selig's battle. The standard of the Black Boar, the Culloch Gorham, flew proud overhead, and at the forefront, sword swinging tirelessly, rode a familiar figure, scarlet cloak swirling from his shoulders. "Truston!" Isandra touched her fingers to her lips, eyes wide with wonder. "Is it really?"
"Oh, it is," Jocelyn assured her. "That's Truston Mab Nectoner."
His riders won through as we watched, forging a ring around the fallen figure of Isidore d'Eglamour. To the southeast, the war chariots of the Dauriada raced in mad circles, sowing chaos and terror in the hearts of the Scaldi, and their foot soldiers carried the Falair Born, the White Horse of Error. A clamour arose closer to home, coming from the courtyard. Later I learned what had happened. A desperate party of Scaldi, abandoned by Selig and caught by the unexpected emergence of the entire garrison of Trois-le-Mont, stormed the gate ere it could be closed. They came close enough on the heels of the emerging army that the defenders of the Barbican dared not shoot. That was how, then, they gained the courtyard. We could see it well enough atop the battlements. A handful of de Somerville's d'Angeline infantry had doubled back to engage them. If the field was in chaos, not so the courtyard. A fierce battle was being waged before the inner gate, with a small knot of d'Angelines fending off thrice as many Scaldi. Gaspard Trevelyan called sharply to our archers, and half of them peeled off, clattering down the tower stairs to align themselves along the parapet of the inner wall overlooking the courtyard. But they faced the same problem as the gatekeepers. There was nowhere to shoot without striking the defenders. The mass of warriors surged, all helms and flailing steel seen from above. One figure among the Dangelines stood out, tall as the tallest Scaldi, making a space around him. It was a pity he was so outnumbered. From beneath his helmet, a long braid of wheat-blonde hair swung like a whip as he fought. Jocelyn made a sharp sound. I thought for a second that he'd been struck. "Luke!" he cried, the bright morning air snatching the word from his lips. "Luke!" "Your brother?" He gave me an agonized nod, hands clenching and unclenching in fists as he crossed his vambraces unthinking. I grasped his arms and shook him, ignoring the pain it cost me. "Can you get to him?" I didn't bother to wait for an answer, seeing in his eyes that he had already gauged the feat. "Then go! Name of Elowa, Jocelyn, go!" White lines formed at either side of his nose and mouth.
"If ever there was a time when I dared not..."
I dug my fists into his hair and dragged his face down to mine, kissing him hard. "I love you," I said fiercely, "and if you ever want to hear those words from my lips again, you will not choose this idiotic vow over your brother's life." Jocelyn's blue eyes went wide and startled, so close to my own. I let him go, and he took one step backward, pressing the back of one hand to his mouth. We stared at one another, and then he whirled, dashing for the tower. I swear I could hear every step of his headlong descent. His figure emerged on the inner wall, diminished by distance, but I could hear the clarion battle cry.
"Varai! Varai!"
Gaspar's bowman gave way, but he scarce hesitated at the parapet, launching himself over its edge, twin daggers drawn. I measured the drop later for myself. It was thrice a grown man's height, at least. Jocelyn's leap, arching, carried him into the thick of the Scaldi attackers. They scattered, I think, as much out of awe as anything. His plunge was like a meteor, but he landed on his feet and came out of his crouch spinning. A pause of breathing space, and his daggers flashed into their sheaths. Out came his sword in a two-handed grip, and he lit into the Scaldi like lightning unchained. A steady roar arose and grew from the Dangeline defenders, centering on the tall form of Luke Verai, whose mighty efforts suddenly doubled in strength. They won, of course. They had to win. "Jocelyn Verai has sworn his sword to my service," Isandra said in my ear, bending down low and amused despite it all. "I remand it to you in perpetuity. And that is my gift for your service, Phaedra No de Launay." I nodded, accepting her gift. What else was I to do? Thus was the day won. In the end, those Scaldi remaining fled the field or surrendered, those who'd gained some measure of Voldemar Selig's wisdom. Below the battlements, Percy de Somerville's standard-bearer dipped his pennant, giving the signal, and Gaspard Trevelyan ordered the horns sounded. The sun was well beyond its apex, and the horns sounded lonely and sad across the ruined plain. The courtyard was won. The fortress of Toilemont stood undefeated. Her armies and allies came limping home. I had not forgotten the lessons of Bryn Gorridum. Over the protests of my queen, who could not find Jocelyn to halt me, I went out to give water to the wounded and dying. So many lost on both sides. If my back burned like fire, so be it. I had won the right through my own blood and sweat and tears to minister to the dying. That is the secret that none dares tell who fights for a cause. Dying, we are all alike. I was Kushiel's chosen, I knew. Pain levels us all. Little enough comfort I had to give, but what I had, I gave. I do not dare voice it to anyone save Jocelyn, but the Scaldi were the worst. Every time I saw fair hair bright with blood beneath the helmet, I thought it might be Gunter Arnlaugsen. He had treated me fair, as best as was in him, and I had repaid him with ruin. I feared to face him for that. I never did find Gunter, nor any of the folk of his steading. I can only pray they were among those who had the sense to flee early, having gained some sense of the true depth of our fierce Dangeline pride, having dwelt so long on our borders. Voldemar Selig, I found, and Deglamour. They lay close together, those fallen, and Drustin's crewinia surrounded them. Their horses nodded, heads low and weary. Drustin Mab Nectna saluted me, staggering as he slid from the saddle and his lame foot gave way beneath him.
"Tell Isandra," he said, and caught at his pommel.
"Tell her yourself," I replied, catching him, gesturing frantically for Lelalia Vale and her apprentices. They came, quick and compassionate. Aishith's folk have a gift for healing, among other things. As I had gifts. Voldemar Selig, who had taken them unasked, lay upon the field, his body broken and twisted, forked beard pointing skyward, and asking unanswered questions of the heavens. I could have answered them, if he'd asked, if he'd ever asked. But he had not asked me, reckoning the soul of Ter Dange lay within its warriors and not its whores. I laid my hand upon his cold face, closing those asking hazel eyes. "We are alike, my lord," I murmured. "We are all alike in the end, and none of us to be had merely for the taking." I heard laughter then, faint and bitter. 17 wounds, I have said. It was true. But Isidore Deglamour was not quite dead of them when I found him.
"Fedra no Delaunay," he whispered, clutching at my hand. "I am afraid of your lord's revenge."
At first I thought he meant Delaunay. Then I knew, through his clutching fingers, who he meant. Bronze wings of fear beat at my eardrums. I gave water to the dying, lifting the skin to his lips. "You have paid, my lord, and paid in full," I said compassionately. "And Kushiel sends no punishment that we are not fit to bear." Isidore Deglamour drank and sighed, sighed and died. That I kept to myself. It was no one's concern but our own, his, mine, and Kushiel's. Then I heard the wailing of the Dalriada. It is an unearthly sound, high and keening, raising the hair at the back of my neck. I did not need to be told what it signified, that so many mourned at once. Releasing my grasp on Deglamour's lifeless hand, I rose and turned. Some distance from me, Drustin shook off the healer's ministrations, standing awkwardly, his eyes dark with concern, in the blue mask of his face. We saw the Dalriada, clustered around one of the chariots, whose team stood steaming in the traces, heavy-headed. I could see the grief on Gronya's face as she looked our way.
"Ah, no," I said, "no."
It was a long walk across the torn field, with the dead lying twisted in my path, blood seeping slow and dark into the dry soil and shredded rootlets. Drustin made it with me, his gait halt and painful. I dare say it cost him as much as it did me, pain flooding my body. "Aemon," I whispered. They had taken him from the chariot and arranged his limbs so that he lay proud and straight on the blood-soaked earth of Ter Dange, and tugged at his armour, so it concealed the terrible rent a scaldy spearhead had made in his side. His hair, never as bright as his sister's, was stiffened to a white crest with lime, spiky against the dark soil. Drustin seized his belt knife and raised it unhesitating, sawing at a thick lock of his black hair. It gave way, and he knelt reverently, placing the lock beneath Aemon's cold hands. "He was braver than lions, and more stalwart than an oak," he said somberly to Gronya. "His name will live forever among the Culloch Gorham." She nodded, her grey eyes bright with tears. "I had brought him here. I did not have the right to mourn. I'm sorry," I murmured to Gronya, to Drustin, to the Dalriada, to all of them, my voice choking. "I'm so sorry." "My brother chose his fate." Even clad in blood-stained armour, Gronya had her dignity, her kindness.
You made him choose to be more than he would have otherwise. Do not deny him that honor. And I had scorned Jocelyn for his castling pride. It is true we are the same in the end. Bowing my head, I borrowed Drustin's belt knife and cut a lock from my own hair, laying it thick and shining beside the cruox. Elwa keep you, Aemon MacConnor. I remembered how he had kept the army organized when the Master of the Straits had parted us, how his sensible manner had aided Gilan to Somerville when we struck out on Dongeline soil. We would have failed without you. Kneeling, I wept, and wept for all of us. Thedra, a familiar voice. Exhausted, I looked up to see Jocelyn, mounted, scratched but unharmed. There were dark circles beneath his eyes. You're in no shape to do this. It was true. I knew it well enough to rise obedient. All the length and breadth of the battlefield, Dongeline troops were about the grim business of gathering the dead and tending to the dying, aided by chirurgeons and healers. "Your brother?" I asked him. "And your father?"
"They are well enough." Jocelyn's voice was hollow. "They survived."
He bowed to Grania from the saddle, a castling bow.
"I grieve for your loss, my lady."
I turned to her and translated, unthinking. Grania smiled sadly.
"Give him our thanks and go with him, Thedrano Delaunay. We will tend to our own."
Drustin's nod echoed her words, and Jocelyn extended his hand to me, leaning down from the saddle. I took it and mounted behind him, and we began the long, slow ride back to Tualamont. Chapter 91. Declamore's surviving forces decided to a man to pursue the fleeing Scaldi. The aftermath of war is a dreadful thing. If ever I had envied Isonde de la Courcelle her crown, and I had not, that would have cured me of it. To her fell the terrible choices of apportioning blame and punishment upon the living and the dead. In the end she chose wisely, I think, granting amnesty to those allies of Cumlach who chose their own dire fate, vowing their lives to hunting down the remainders of Selig's vast army. No one gainsaid it, the memory of Isidore Deglamore's last sacrificial battle too fresh in mind. As for those Scaldi who had surrendered, it was my counsel, among that of others, to accept ransom for them. I knew well how much Dongeline treasure had found its way across the border, thanks to Deglamore's sanctioned raids. In truth, I'd no heart for further bloodshed, but neither, I think, had Isandra, nor many of her supporters. So the Scaldi were ransomed and sent home, and the borders were sealed against them. Enough had died. As for the reunion of Isandra and Drustin, I was there to witness it. So were some thousands of Dongelines and Albans. He came riding with the Alban army at his back, while she threw open the gates of Tualamont to welcome him. They greeted each other as equals, then clasped hands, and he drew her hands to his lips and kissed them. Our conjoined armies shouted approval, though I did not see it reflected in all the eyes of Dongeline nobility. Wars come and go, politics endure. For those seeking a higher degree of romance, I can only say that Isandra and Drustin knew too well who and what they were. The Queen of Terre d'Ange and the Cruach of Alba. With the armed forces of two nations watching, they dared be no less and no more. I have come to know Isandra passing well since then, and I believe what fell between them, behind closed doors, was another matter. I know Drustin too, and I know how he loved her. But they were monarchs alike, and had ever understood it would be so, and that is the face they showed to the nation. One thing was sure, no one publicly would dare speak against their union. We owed our lives and our sovereignty to Alba, and their allegiance was unquestioned. Amid the mourning and burying, the ransoming and the celebrating, a date was set, a wedding to be held in the city of Elwa. Jocelyn and I were another matter.
I met his father and his brother, and two men-at-arms who had survived the terrible battle. What I had expected, I don't know. Nothing, truly. I was numb for days afterward, too tired to think. I spent days and nights at Isandra's call, translating at will, for Cruinia and Scaldi alike. There were some others as skilled, it is true, in all that mass of folk, but none she trusted as she did me, Delaunay's other pupil. And there were the hospital wards, too, with many Albans in them, and some of Fedra's boys as well, of whom no more than a dozen had survived. Racked with anguish, I spent time at each of their bedsides. Still, I found the time when Jocelyn informed me that House Ferrai would be leaving. With Deglamour's forces committed to the pursuit of the Scaldi, it freed Percy de Somerville to release the most far-flung vestiges of the royal army. The standing army, of course, would remain intact, mobilizing to reinforce the Scaldi border, but those who had abandoned home and hearth to serve were dismissed with thanks and honor, especially the wounded. There was a special ceremony, too, for the valiant spear company of the Royal House of Aragon, whose commander made pledges of friendship on behalf of his king, with not only Isandra, but the young Cruach of Alba as well. Percy de Somerville's reunion with Guilain had brought tears to my eyes, father and son embracing, pounding one another's backs with lagnosite disregard for onlookers. The Chevalier Millar Verai, the stump of his missing left hand bound in a sling, was cooler with his son, but it was only his way, I think. He was a tall, lean man, with greying hair in an austere Siobhanese braid, and the same old-fashioned beauty as his middle son. I had learned since the battle that he had been the first in the courtyard to reach the inner gate, had lost his shield and hand alike, defending it.
"I understand you are somewhat of a scholar," he said gravely, when Jocelyn had made the introductions.
I opened my mouth and closed it. It was not entirely untrue, but I had never been thus introduced. "I do but sample from the feast table of my forefathers," I said in Caerdyche, quoting the Tiberian orator Nunnius Balbo. Jocelyn's father smiled unexpectedly, the corners of his eyes crinkling.
"Namar's servants are seldom so learned in Siobhal," he said, laying his sound hand on my shoulder. "A rebellion against the teachings of Shemhazai, mayhap."
"Shemhazai had his passions, my lord," I replied, smiling back at him, "and Namar her store of wisdom." The Chevalier Verai laughed, patting my shoulder.
"I have heard what you did," he said, growing serious once more. "Terre d'Ange owes you a great debt for your service."
I inclined my head, uncomfortable with praise. "If not for your son, I would be dead many times over, my lord."
"I know."
He shifted his sling and rested his gaze on Jocelyn with quiet pride.
"Whether or not I agree with the path you have chosen, I cannot say, but you have acquitted yourself upon it with honour."
Jocelyn bowed and said nothing. His brother Luke, half a head taller than both of them, grinned.
"Can't disagree, seeing the cause," he remarked, beaming at me.
Luke had the same fair hair and blue eyes as his brother, but an open, merry cast to his features that must surely be their mother's legacy.
"Elowa, will you come visit us at least, Fedra? You ought to give me a fair chance before you decide on Jocelyn."
I wasn't sure how Jocelyn would take his brother's teasing. We'd scarce had a private moment to speak since I'd kissed him on the battlements. I didn't even know what it meant myself. But glancing sidelong at him, I saw the corner of his mouth twitch with the shadow of a smile. "Neither of us have decided anything, my lord," I replied to Luke, "but I would be honoured to see Verai." He grinned again, clapping Jocelyn on the shoulder.
"You can come too, I suppose. Did you know you're an uncle 5 times over? Jahan's been wed 6 years, and Honor almost 4.
"I will some day," Jocelyn murmured.
"You would be welcome," his father said firmly, "any day. Your mother longs to see you."
He looked gently upon me.
"'And you will always be welcome in our home, Fedrano Delaunay. "'I knew the Comte de Montreve, you know. "'I think in the end he would have been very proud of his son, Anarfiel, "'and what he has wrought in you.'
"'Thank you, my lord. "'It meant more than I would have guessed. "'Tears stung my eyes, and I hoped that somewhere in the true Terre d'Ange that lies beyond, "'Delaunay had won his father's pride.' I stood back and let them make their final farewells alone, then. There was a small party of Siovalis departing altogether that morning. Luke Verai turned in the saddle as they rode away, the sunlight bright on his wheat-blonde hair.
"'They sing some interesting songs about you in the hospital ward, Vergino Delaunay,' he shouted, laughing.
"'Blessed Eloah!' I could feel the flush rising. "'Wounded or no, Rouse's damned soldiers, Fedra's boys, would teach that damned song to anyone who would listen.
"'They adore you,' Jocelyn said dryly. "'They've earned the right.'
I shuddered. "'But in front of your father!'
"'I know.'
He watched them ride away, joining the train of Siovalis. He wanted to speak to the prefect about rescinding his edict against me. My heart unexpectedly leapt into my throat. "'What did you say?' I asked, striving to keep my voice calm. Jocelyn glanced at me.
"'I said no.'
Another faint smile twitched at the corner of his lips, glinted in his blue eyes.
"'After all, I have my vow to think of.'
How long had it been since I had laughed, truly laughed? I couldn't remember. I laughed then, and felt it like a clean wind in my spirit— while Jocelyn regarded me with amusement. "'We do need to talk, though,' I said, when I had caught my breath. He nodded, sobering. But just then one of Isandra's pages came at a run across the drawbridge, searching for me. I was needed, and our conversation must be put off that day. As it was the next, and the day after, so it is with common folk, when the affairs of the mighty command their attention— and whatever part Jocelyn and I had played in the tapestry of war, we were but bit-players once more in the arena of politics. Isandra kept her court at Toilemont, while the nation restabilized. D'Angeline nobles came daily to the fortress, renewing pledges of loyalty in some cases, in others divulging the disloyalty of their peers. She gauged them all with an astuteness beyond her years, aided by the counsel of Gaspard Trevelyan and Barquiel Lambert, and two of Justin Mabnectina, who understood a great deal more than most people reckoned. They betrayed themselves sometimes, those who had plotted against her, gazing in startlement at his face, blue-world and strange. It was not strange to me, not any longer. I met privately with him each day to tutor him in D'Angeline, and was ever more impressed with his quiet, intuitive wisdom. A constant watch was kept on the battlements, and every day the horn sounded, announcing some new arrival. I grew inured to it, scarce wondering any more who approached, merely marking the banners and insignia, checking them against the catalogue Delaunay had required Alcuin and me to memorize. I knew a great many of them, although Alcuin had known them all. I was at the smithy, settling an argument for two of the minor lords of the Dalriada regarding repairs to their war chariots, a new linchpin and wheel rims, and took no notice of the horns that morning, until Jocelyn appeared and caught at my arm. "'What is it?' I asked. His face was unreadable.
"'Come and see.'
"'The work is done. Let them have the chariots,' I said to the smith. "'The Cruach will see you paid for your labour.' I do not like to admit it, but some of the D'Angeline craftsmen who had flocked to Toilemont were inclined to take advantage of the Albans. I hurried into the keep after Jocelyn, mounting the spiral stairs of the tower, ignoring the faint twitches of pain from my still-healing back. On the battlements he pointed to the west, where a party was advancing toward the fortress.
There.
They rode in a square formation, arranged around a single figure at their centre, with two outriders on either side. Standards flew at the corners of the square. I knew the device, a raven and the sea. Quinsel de Morbon. I caught my breath, wondering, and then felt Jocelyn's fingers at my elbow, a grip almost hard enough to hurt. I knew the figure de Morban's men surrounded, too. There was no mistaking it, even at a distance. Proud and straight in the saddle, head held high, rippling curtain of blue-black hair. The world rippled in my vision, crenellated walls of the battlements tilting sideways. Only Jocelyn's grip held me upright. At my throat, Melisande's diamond sparkled like the sun, and hung heavy as a millstone. "Melisande," I whispered, "our Eloa." Chapter 92. I do not think the Duke de Morban could have brought her in without aid. It was her own kin who had betrayed her, the two outriders proving to be Shara's eye, riding hooded even in the heat of summer, shadowing their features. Younger members of the house they were, Marmion and Persia, who sold their cousin's whereabouts to Quinsel de Morban in return for his favour. After we had departed the shores of Terre d'Ange in Rouse's flagship, de Morban had kept his word, interrogating the admiral's men. Rouse hadn't told them everything, but enough, and they gave away enough for de Morban to put events together. And, too, rumours reached his ears, as surely they had Melisande's, that members of the Castelline Brotherhood, serving as couriers for Isandra's loyal allies, asked about Melisande Charizai where they rode. De Morban was no fool, and had held sovereignty in Kushith long enough to know how to deal with House Charizai. He kept his knowledge to himself, and waited for matters to unfold. While the nation went to war, Quinsel de Morban bided his time. When mighty waves roiled the straits, and word reached him of an Alban fleet landing on Dangeline's soil, he cast the die, and went a-hunting Melisande Charizai. He found her, in an isolated hold in southern Kushith, preparing to journey, as Marmion and Persia had said he would. That much they knew, having aided her, not enough to convict her. Word spread like wildfire through Toilemont as Melisande was brought into the keep. Everyone knew something, it seemed, and no one knew enough. Melisande played a deep game. The edifice of proof of her guilt had crumbled on the battlefield. "I'm sorry," Isandra said compassionately to me. "I would have spared you this, if I could." I drew a deep breath and shivered. "I know, my lady." The hearing was held in the throne room, cool and dim behind thick stone walls, lit by lamps and torches, even in the heart of summer. I stood behind Isandra's throne, behind her two castellines, and the rank of her Courcelle guard. Even Jocelyn was no comfort in this, although he stood close at my side. Quinsel de Morban came forward to bend his knee before Isandra, pledging his loyalty. What he said I cannot remember. All my senses were fixed on one point in that room. He stood aside then, and Melisande Charizai came forward, flanked by his men, though they dared not touch her. "Lady Melisande Charizai," Isandra's voice, cool as a blade, cut through the flame-streaked air. "You stand before us, accused of treason. How do you plead?"
"Your Majesty," Melisande curtsied, smooth and graceful, her face calm and lovely. "I am your loyal servant, and innocent of the charge." I could see Isandra lean forward.
"You are charged with conspiring with Isidore de Glamour to betray the nation and seize the throne. Do you deny this?"
Melisande smiled. I knew that smile well. I have seen it a thousand times, waking and sleeping. Torchlight glimmered on her hair and her ivory features, making twin stars of her deep blue eyes. "For a thousand years House Charizai has served the throne," she said, and her voice was like honey, rich and sweet. "We who are Dangeline, we are vulnerable to beauty, always." I could hear the assembled crowd murmur.
"His Grace de Morban makes charges, but he offers no proof, and has much to gain, if his loyalty and my estates alike are at stake." Melisande turned out her hands in an eloquent gesture, lifting her gaze to Isandra's.
Such surety, such confidence, her guilt laid buried beneath the battlefield, in the long sleep of death.
Where was he when battle was waged for D'Angeline's sovereignty? Yes, your majesty, I refute the charge. If he has proof, let him offer it.
How much, in truth, de Morban had guessed, I was not sure, but I knew then how much he had told her. Nothing.
The isolation that had protected Melisande had made her vulnerable, and Quinsel de Morban had disarmed her in the only way possible. He had kept her shrouded in ignorance.
"You are charged, too," Isandra said, watching her closely, "with conspiring with Voldemar Selig of the Skaldi."
It took Melisande by surprise. I could see her eyelids flicker. Then she laughed easily and gracefully.
"Does the Duke claim as much? Well, might I say it of him, or anyone, your majesty. It is an easy charge to make that may not be gainsaid by the dead."
"No," Isandra said, "not de Morban."
Melisande grew still, her gaze sharpening as she regarded Isandra.
"Do I not have the right, your majesty, to know who accuses me?" she asked, her voice low and dangerous.
Isandra did not waver, but made a slight gesture with one hand. The rank of her guard parted in front of me, and I stepped forth trembling.
"I do," I said softly, meeting Melisande's eyes. I raised one hand and grasped the diamond at my throat, tearing it loose with one sharp jerk. The velvet lead broke, and I held the diamond in my hand, cords trailing. I tossed it on the flagstones between us.
"That is yours, my lady," I said, taking a shuddering breath. "I am not."
In the profound silence of the throne room, Melisande Shara's eye went a deadly white.
To her credit, she gave no other sign, but stood unmoving, as the two of us looked at one another. Then, impossibly, she gave a short laugh and looked away.
"My Lord de Launay," she murmured, gazing into the distance, "you play a considerable endgame."
No one spoke, as her sapphire-blue gaze returned to rest thoughtfully on me.
That was the one thing I couldn't fathom. Percy de Somerville was prepared for Selig's invasion. You?
"I saw a letter you wrote to Selig in your own hand." My voice was shaking. "You should have killed me when you had the chance."
Melisande stooped and picked up the diamond lead that lay between us, dangling it from one hand.
"Leaving you with the Castelline was a bit excessive," she agreed, glancing at Jocelyn, who stood impassive, eyes blazing. "Although it seems to have agreed with him."
"Do you dispute this charge?"
Isandra raised her voice, cool and implacable, severing the tension between us. Melisande looked at the diamond in her hand, closing her fist around it, arching her brows.
"You have proof, I assume, of their story?"
"I have palace guards who will swear they saw them with you the night of Anafiel de Launay's murder."
Isandra's expression was calm and merciless.
"And I believe, my lady Charizai, that 30,000 invading Skaldi attest to the truth of their tale."
Melisande shrugged.
"Then I have no more to say."
"So be it," Isandra summoned her guard. "You will be executed at dawn."
No one, not Trevelyan, nor Lambert, nor de Morban, nor the assembled peers, and not her Charizai kin, heads downcast, spoke in her defence.
I watched, trembling, as the Courcelle guard surrounded Melisande, escorting her out of the throne room.
"It's over," Jocelyn murmured at my ear. "It's over, Fedra."
"I know," I touched my throat, where no diamond lay,
and wondered why I felt so empty. I spent a long time in the hospital wards that day and evening, finding solace in tending to the injured. I'd no medical skills to speak of, although Lalalia Valet had a shy young medical student who was kind enough to instruct me in simple matters, changing bandages and washing fevered wounds with herbal infusions. Mostly, it helped the wounded to see a kind face, to have a listening ear. I had scavenged parchment and ink from the tiny library some days ago. I took letters for some of them who had come to realize that they would never see home again. A small kindness, but it meant a great deal to the dying. I spent much of my time with the Kruinya and Tarriada, who could not even communicate with the healers who tended them. Drustin had a veritable sheaf of letters already that he had promised would reach Alban soil, and bards and Brihans to read them if their recipients could not. Wise enough in his own way, Jocelyn left me be. I do not think he ever understood truly what lay between Melisande and I. How could he, when I scarce understood it myself? It would have been simpler before I dared the crossing of Selig's camp, before the torture. I despised her for what she had done, both to me and to Terre d'Ange. And yet, Elowen knew I had loved her once. It was well into the small hours of the night when the messenger found me. Unsure of his errand, he looked uncomfortable, whispering in the quiet air of the sick room. "My Lady Phaedra, I am bid to summon you. The Lady Melisande Shahrazai would speak with you, if you are willing. If you ever have a chance to confront her alone, don't take it." I did not forget Hyacinth's words, but I went anyway. There were two guards at her door, Isandra's and Loyal. Even though they knew me, they checked me carefully for weapons before admitting me. It was an irony that Melisande had a chamber to herself. No one else did, save Isandra, with the fortress full to overflowing. But she was a peer of the realm and a scion of Kushiel. She deserved as much, her last night on earth. I wondered who had been displaced, that she might spend it in comfort. It was a small chamber, two chairs, a writing table and a bed only. I entered and heard the door closed behind me, the bolt shot fast. Melisande, seated in one of the chairs, glanced up as I entered. "I wasn't sure you'd come," she remarked in greeting, arching her perfect brows. "And without your warder, too." "What do you want?" I remained standing. She only laughed, that rich laugh that turned my very bones to water, even now, even still. "To see you," she said then, "before I die. Is that so much to ask?" "From you," I said, "yes." "Phaedra." Her lips shaped my name, her voice gave it meaning. I caught at the back of the second chair to steady myself, and her eyes watched me, amused. "Do you hate me that much?" "Yes," I whispered, willing it to be true. "Why don't you?"
"Ah, well," Melisande shrugged. "I was careless, and you played the hand I dealt you. Shall I blame you for that? I knew you were Delaunay's creature when I dealt it. It might have been different if I had claimed you for my own, and not given you leave to choose."
"No," I said.
"Who can say?" She smiled wryly. "But I will admit, I underestimated you gravely. You and that half-mad Castline of yours. I've heard tales, you know, from the guards. You went to Alba, they say."
I clutched the chair back. "What did Selig promise you?" I asked, making my voice hard.
"Half an empire," Melisande leaned back casually. "I heard his name when he offered marriage to the daughter of the Duke of Milazzo. I was curious. He thought I offered him Terre d'Ange. But I would have taken Scaldia in the end, you know,
or our children would have, if I'd not lived to see it.
I know.
I did not doubt it. I had guessed as much, the deep workings of her plot. A wave of hysterical laughter bubbled up within me, caught in my throat, and left me choking.
You might have been happy with him, my lady, I said wildly. He'd worked half his way through the Trois Mille Joies with me.
Did he? She murmured. I closed my eyes to shut out the sight of her.
Why did you flee the city when Ganelon died? I thought you knew.
By the sweeping sound of her skirt, I could tell Melisande had risen. No, I knew Ganelon was dying, that's true. And I knew that Telesis de Mornay had an audience with Isandra. And the next day her guards were asking questions about the night Delaunay was killed. A silken rustle of a shrug. I thought the king's poet had persuaded Isandra to open a new investigation into his death. It was enough to render my absence prudent. Her plans were already in motion then. It wouldn't have mattered if Jocelyn and I hadn't staggered out of the white depths of Scaldic Winter with a wild tale on our lips. I opened my eyes to see Melisande gazing out the narrow window of her chamber at the dark night. Why? I whispered, knowing the question was futile, needing to ask it anyway. She turned around, serene and beautiful.
Because I could. There would never be any other answer.
As much as I might wish for a reason, I could understand, in my heart, and not only in the dark, intuitive part of me that shuddered away from such comprehension. It would never come.
It would never have been different, I said harshly, willing the words to hurt her, willing her to flinch under their impact. Never before had I known what it was to desire another's pain. I knew it then. No matter what you did, no matter what claim you put on me, I would never have aided you in this.
No. Melisande smiled, amused. Are you so sure of that, Phaedra no Delaunay? Her voice, low and honeyed, sent shivers across my skin, and I stood rooted as she crossed the room. Almost idle, one hand traced the line of my mark hidden beneath my gown. It awakened the wound Selig had dealt me, and pain flared outward, suffusing my body. I could feel the heat of her presence, her scent. Nothing had changed. My will bent before hers as she cupped my cheek with one hand, face rising obediently to hers, my world tilted around her axis. "That which yields," she murmured, lowering her lips toward mine, "is not always weak." A kiss, almost. Her lips brushed mine and withdrew, hands leaving my skin, and I staggered in the abyss of her sudden absence in a shock of yearning.
"So your Tsingano said," Melisande looked at me, eyes gone cold. "I remembered as much. But I should have paid closer attention when he told me to choose my victories wisely."
She sat down in the facing chair and nodded at the door.
"You may go now, and leave me to consider my death."
I went. I knocked blindly at the door of her chamber, stumbling through it when Isandra's guard shot the bolt and opened it, finding the stone wall of the hallway with fumbling hands.
"Are you all right, my lady?"
one of them asked, anxious. I heard the door close hard behind me, and nodded. "Yes," I whispered, knowing I was not at all. But that there was nothing they could do to help, nor anyone. We should both, I thought, have listened to Hyacinth. The dreadful laughter threatened to rise, and I bowed my head, sliding my hands across my face. Melisande. Chapter 93. The drowsing guards let me be, disturbing me only to offer a sip of cordial from their flasks, leaving me alone with my turmoil. I have always found there to be solace in the vastness of open spaces, beneath the vault of the heavens. It is a comfort in anguish to be reminded of the scale of one's own troubles against the mighty breadth of the world. What would I have done, truly, if Melisande had bought my mark instead of paying it? If she had never loosed the lead she set upon me? I was sure, very nearly, entirely sure, that I had spoken the truth. Very nearly. But she had accomplished her intent. I would never be entirely sure of it, not entirely. In the end, of course, it didn't matter. What had happened was done, and my choices made. At dawn, Melisande Shahrazai would be no more, condemned to death by accusation, and no one ever would be troubled by her again, except for me. Such were the thoughts that ran through my mind as I passed the long night's vigil, listening to the quiet stirrings of the sleeping fortress, the murmur of guards, the rattle and stamp of horses in the stable, the occasional creak of a door. These things I heard, and no more. Jocelyn found me as the skies were turning a dull grey, and I was thinking how I had seen far too many bloody dawns. I was a servant of Nama. My daybreak should be stained with the red blood of the grape, and not mortal flesh.
"You went to see her,"
he said in a low voice behind me. I nodded without looking.
"Why?"
"I don't know. I owed her that much, I suppose." I turned around then, seeing his familiar face sober in the grey light. "Jocelyn, there are things I will never be able to forget, and there will be times I need to try."
"I know,"
he said gently, coming to stand beside me. "You know that I could never hurt you, even if you asked it of me." "I know." I drew a deep breath and took his arm. An Anguisette and a Castelline, Eloa help us. We've survived 30,000 Scaldi and the wrath of the Master of the Straits. We ought to be able to survive each other. Jocelyn laughed softly, and I buried my face in his chest. There was so much between us, and so much that would ever be between us, and yet I knew I did not want to be without him. We stood like that for a long while, and I felt the long night's dread leave me. The grey skies were paling, the rays of the new sun stealing long and low across the battlements. Soon it would be done and over. So I was thinking, as the sound of shouting and the rattle of guards running in armour arose. Time and enough for the night watch to be relieved. Yet I did not remember it happening like this, new guards taking over stern-faced, a harried commander interrogating the members of the night watch, who were all shaking heads and urgent denial.
"What is it?" Jocelyn caught at the captain as he passed. "They were to execute the Lady Melisande Shahrazai at dawn," he said, his face grim. "She's gone. Two guards dead at her door, and the keeper of the postern gate."
Shaking off Jocelyn's hand, he added, "Excuse me," and hurried onward. Atop the battlements we stared at one another, and a last desperate laugh caught in my throat worked its way loose. "Melisande!" I gasped. "Ah, Elowen, no!" Isandra turned the fortress upside down, sent riders in all directions, and had everyone at liberty that night questioned. Everyone. She found no trace of Melisande, who had vanished like an apparition. Not even Jocelyn was exempted from her interrogation, nor was I. Surely not I. Isandra summoned me to the throne room, and I knew what it was like to stand before her where Melisande had stood. "She sent for you that night," Isandra said, her voice cold and hard as steel. "And you went. Do not deny it, Fedra. We know as much from the hospital wards. Why?" I answered her as I had Jocelyn, except that I clasped my hands together to hide their shaking. "Your Majesty, I owed her that much." "Whatever you owed her, the coin she paid was treason." Isandra's face was implacable. "We do not reckon debts thusly in Terre d'Ange."
"She spared my life once," I whispered. "I'd no more kill you than I'd destroy a priceless fresco or a vase. And I did not. That much I owed her."
"And what else?"
Isandra's fair brows raised.
"Nothing."
I raked my hands through my hair and choked on the terrible laughter that still welled inside me. "Your Majesty, the only proof of her treason rests on my word. What need had I to save her but remain silent?"
Isandra's face changed, turning compassionate. She knew well enough the truth of my words.
"You're right, of course. I'm sorry, Fedra. But you must understand, while she is free with allies to aid her, I will never rest easy on my throne."
"Nor should you," I murmured the words, escorted from the royal presence with considerably more courtesy than I'd been brought with. The Queen of Terdange had apologized to me. It was something to note.
In the first flush of victory, I had regarded everyone who had fought at Toilemont as friend and ally. When the politicking set in later, I regained a measure of perspective. But after Melisande's flight, it changed, and I could look at no one in the same light. One of us was a traitor. The mystery went unresolved in the end. Wherever Melisande Charizai had gone, and whoever had aided her, their complicity was buried deep enough that it was never uncovered. And there was a realm to be governed, and a wedding planned. Riders continued to issue forth from Toilemont,